having some technical difficulties there getting started, but finally figured it out, just 4 minutes behind. Welcome, everyone. Taking stock. Today is June 26, 2024, and really looking forward to a great discussion today. I've been looking into different types of share dilutions all afternoon, and going to be going over some of the different types of vehicles that companies will use when they're seeking to acquire more equity, some of the reasons that they might be doing this in the first place, some of the downsides of the legacy system when it comes to this whole process, and how all of these different things can affect our, when I say our, I mean investors, how all these different things can affect investors' holdings. So looking forward to all of that. It's been, I think, a bit of a hot topic in our listener base over the last couple of weeks and maybe month or so, since GameStop did recently initiate and then complete two different shelf offerings. For both of those, they ended up simply selling common stock into the market, which is the simplest and most common form of dilution events from my research, but there are a ton of different kinds. And if you look at any of the given prospectus, which will be filed and detail these different things, hop onto Edgar. You can look up the 424B5 filings. You'll find that companies will often list off a whole bunch of different vehicles. And the reason they do that is because just because you're filing today and you have an idea of what you want to raise, maybe it ends up that you're going to seek some different type of equity offering, and keep them guessing and leave your options open. Those are good ways to do it. Certainly, if anyone does want to hop on up and add to the conversation, just raise the hand or indicate to me somehow. Always happy to bring folks on that want to join in. But with all that being said, we can go ahead and get started with some basic definitions when it comes to share dilution. And I went ahead and grabbed some basic definition and a quick example off of the Investopedia page I was pretty happy with, so I'll hop right into that. Share dilution is when a company issues additional stock, reducing the ownership proportion of a current shareholder. Shares can be diluted through a conversion by holders of optional securities, secondary offerings to raise capital, or offering new shares in exchange for acquisitions or services. That's their kind of overbroad definition. And we're going to hop into more detail on every one of those sentences. But what's the TLDR of that TLDR? Essentially, sometimes companies need funds for a variety of reasons, and share offerings where they are increasing the amount of issued shares trading in the market are one way to accumulate that equity. Investopedia also had this small example that I'll read off quick. Let's assume a small business has 10 shareholders and each shareholder holds one share, which is 10% of the company. So if they all have equal voting rights, maybe they're all common stock, then each one of them has 10% control. Now let's say for some reason that the company decides to seek additional equity. Maybe they decide to sell 10 new shares. And let's even say that all 10 of those shares are bought by a single investor. That would now mean there's 20 shares outstanding. The new investor owns 50% of the company. And each of those investors who held one share before still own one share, but now they have just 5% of the voting power each. So their ownership was diluted by this new issuance. I think that's going to be a really important thing that I'll keep coming back to here. Because ultimately, in terms of the stock price or the, implied equity that you have as an investor, a lot of the time that can go up. Let's, if a company is doing a dilutive event because they have an expansion planned, a new product, right? A lot of the time we see stock value go up in the short term, or rather, let's say in the short term during the dilution, the stock value can often go down because there's a lot of buying pressure. And a lot of new stock entering the market. Then in the medium term, maybe it goes back up and your equity as measured in dollars could be higher. but importantly, your ownership percentage, that's gone down, and that has definitely gone down. So as far as how this gets announced, intention of companies to go through dilution events are confirmed ahead of time with an SEC filing. Now, this is often a 4245B, as I mentioned before. You can definitely hop on Edgar and take a look. You'll find that a lot of the language in here that these different prospectuses have, there's a lot of similarities between them because they have to cover a lot of the same ground. They're going to detail the maximum amount of shares to be sold, a rough time frame within which that sale can occur, and which, if any, outside parties are supervising legal proceedings or acting as a sales agent. So, and what is a sales agent, or what does that supervising entail? The process for administering these offerings while remaining compliant with the SEC regulations can be tough sometimes. And these sales agents often receive a percentage of raised capital. That percentage is going to be outlined in that SEC filing so that everyone is on the same page. You know, generally, as I mentioned before, regardless of what type of sale the company plans to make, multiple different vehicles are usually detailed within the filing in order to keep those choices open. So taking GameStop, for example, here, just since that I think is going to be near and dear to a lot of the listener base, and it's also a recent example, GameStop is a company that only has common share outstanding, Class A common shares, the most basic form of equity available currently issued and trading in the market. They have the ability to issue preferred shares, but they have not. So that makes it pretty simple as far as, you know, when you're calculating things like market cap or voter power, anything like these things, because it's an integer of issued shares that are available and they're all equal. Many companies don't have this kind of simplicity. A lot of the time, there might be multiple different classes of shares. There's no upper bound on how many different types there could be. And there are also a bunch of other different dilutive vehicles that I'm going to want to get into here. But the reason I bring up GameStop as an example first is because although they only have the Class A common shares making up their issued and outstanding, and although both of these recent shelf offerings and the one that they did in 2021, all three of them were completed entirely by the release of new issued shares, Class A common shares into the market. In all these cases, they did include a bunch of other investment vehicle options that they might use to facilitate this capital growth. So what are some examples of those? And I'll just kind of rattle off a list here. Again, if you look up this these filings in Edgar, you'll find that it's quite common, regardless of what types of shares a company has to begin with or what they end up choosing to use to facilitate their dilution event, they're usually going to mention all these different options. So it's fairly straightforward as far as that. But it's important to know what all these different things are just in case the company does decide to use them, because they have the option to do so. They always give themselves the option to do so. So let's start up with stock options. A stock option is pretty straightforward. Essentially, it's, if you're familiar with typical options in the broader market, you know that it's the right to buy or the right to sell securities at some later date, at some later price. And you can have stock options with the issuing company as well. So if you happened to have some agreement through this dilution event that, for the next year, or I can, purchase Class A common shares for some amount, then that's a form of dilution, because although the stock option holder may not exercise the option immediately, they would have the ability to do so at any time, and that would increase the operating, issued stock amount or operating float of that company. Another sort of example of that is like a restricted share unit. That's something that's often provided to like insiders or something like this. Typically, they have a vesting period. And what these different terms mean, a RSU, that's like a promise of future equity. So you're being told that you will receive such and such shares on such and such date. And that vesting period is how long until that time. So once that vesting period has concluded and those restricted share units are distributed, you know, that's almost like the moment they are, air quotes, issued, and the holder can then do what they want with them, whether or not that's continue to hold them, to sell them, whatever it might be. So that is a dilution in a different way, where rather than the stock option, which you can't predict if it will be exercised or when it will be exercised, at least with an RSU, you know exactly when that vesting period will be over. That's typically going to be something outlined in an earlier company filing, making sure that investors are aware of how that's going to impact, you know, their own shareholdings, their own percentage of ownership. Sometimes companies, here a third one, sometimes companies can offer what are called depository shares. Essentially, and this one was something that was, I was just learning a lot about today in preparation for this episode. But to my reading, depository shares are an option of a company to provide access to a depository, which may be controlled by the company, part of, part of them. But essentially, they provide to investors depository receipts that provide evidence that you have a claim to the right to vote, the right to receive dividends, and so on for the shares which are included in that depository. For longtime listeners, for enthusiasts of modern markets, I'm sure that the idea of depositories is nothing new to you. Essentially, a depository is anytime you have a whole bunch of stock, which is, has collective, is collectively beneficially owned by a whole bunch of other folks, but it's kept together for liquidity, for ease of accounting. A variety of different reasons are justifiable, I suppose, for that. And I hadn't realized that companies could set up small internal depositories, but it is something that is commonly mentioned in these prospectus plans. Following that, I also wanted to bring up this they have the ability to write stock purchase contracts, which is similar to a stock option. It's sort of similar to a restricted share unit also. Essentially, the stock purchase contract is like a stock option, but upon the date of execution that is described in the contract, they don't get a choice whether or not to exercise. You have to, whatever the contract said, buy X amount at Y price, sell X amount at Y price, upon the date that will be happening, regardless. It's a commitment to do that at this later date. So that, those are kind of nice in that if your company has them, then you can examine those and math out exactly when and by how much dilution is going to be affecting your holdings. Now, when we'll get more into that shortly. Just two left here as far as the, there's three left. See, there's a bunch of different vehicles available. A stock warrant is like a financial instrument that gives an investor the right to buy or sell a specific number of shares of a company stock at a predetermined price within a certain time frame. So this is a bit like a stock option, but can be, essentially, it's available, I think. My understanding from the distinction was that it was available to a broader subset of investors. Sometimes warrants are, if they are up for sale, that can be more openly accessible. Then stock options are often more something closer to like an insider or part of a deal with other companies, things like this. Okay, nearly through. Subscription rights are also an option that can be sold by a company. Essentially, a subscription right is the ability for an investor to, in future dilution events, they get kind of first dibs at buying up shares that are being newly issued or other vehicles that are being offered as part of the dilution. So I wasn't able to find any direct examples when I was looking around because I was curious about how that would work, but it is listed in the filings as something that they can sell or provide, I suppose, to individuals or to companies if they would like to. And then lastly, this is almost the silliest one. A unit is pretty much just a bundle of any of the above. So perhaps if there was a, you know, if a company wanted to sell 10 shares of common stock and a warrant to buy 10 more shares of common stock together at once, you couldn't get one without the other. That would be a unit. And that is completely customizable. It can contain any combination and any amount of any of the above items. So really there's any way that you might want to slice it. When a company includes the ability to provide units as part of their equity offer, you know, their equity development, that means that to me that it sounds like, you know, they could enter into a agreement with any individual buyer and really work out something that is a fit to order for both parties. So there's quite a lot of customization there. I will include in the notes of this episode a link to the most recent GME prospectus and that does list off all of their language and definitions for everything I just rattled off, and a link to an Edgar search for similar types of prospectus so that folks can review that the language is pretty similar or almost exactly similar in some cases with, you know, plenty of other companies that are doing similar sorts of things. So, oof, that's a ton. That's a ton of different vehicle options available to companies. The next kind of broad thing that I want to talk about here is, you know, why might a company dilute? This is a shorter and broader, broader still subject, but I see we've got some great listeners here. Just want to mention again that if you do want to chime in on any of that, kind of talk about some of these different investment vehicles or why you think a company might lean one way versus another, I'm always interested to hear from the community. Just raise the hands if you'd like to pop in. So why might a company dilute? Broadly, right? Companies dilute because they want to raise capital. And that could be because they need to pay off debts, to have more capital available for their operating costs. They want to make new investments, or they have acquisitions that they're looking after. Maybe they want to invest in a new product or strategic partnership, buying out a competitor. There could be a ton, right, of different reasons that a company would want to raise capital. And a lot of the time, it may not be immediately clear or made immediately clear why a company wants to do that. You know, they can say, they can indicate their goals for what they want to raise or things like this, but typically, it's going to be important to remember that they have a ton of different reasons that they might want to raise capital. And sometimes dilution events and share offerings are the best way to do it, because you might not be able to, you know, depending on the debt environment, on interest rates, on other sorts of liquidity and cash availability, maybe loans are not as feasible of an option as they might be at some other time or for some other companies. And pretty much at any point, a company is going to be able to initiate some kind of dilution event if they needed capital immediately. Oh, I see, John, how are you doing? I see you hopped on as speaker. Well, welcome.
Hey, Chives. Seems like you've done a lot of research and really digging deep into these dilution events. So stellar work on that part.
Trying, John. How are you doing today?
I'm doing, you know, it's been... I wish I had more time. Just a lot happening, a lot moving. But in terms of, you know, how it really matters, I think we're making some tremendous progress in the Discord on really organizing. It was a great conversation last week, and we had a great conversation going on in the Discord. I don't know if he sort of changed his name, if he prefers Bob or if it's Don, but definitely some really interesting Web3 things that have been fermenting in the ecosystem to to talk into too. It's interesting you talk about the rights offering and the pools of shares with the depositories. There's really a lot to dive into. A lot of CFOs at big public companies, they might not even, it depends on sort of who the custodian is for the depository. I talked to one executive of a big name you'd know, and they had no idea that Wall Street was making depository shares of their Japanese holding company, and they were not involved at all with it becoming available in the U.S. markets. And it is interesting to see how they raise capital from those investors using that vehicle and ultimately paying some fees, whether it's the recurring fees that investors pay on depository shares, whether it's the underwriting fees that someone like GameStop pays on the shelf offerings, or just any kind of registered offering that does use like a 424 or some other kind of dissemination of the sales. It really gets down to exactly what you were saying, which is how do we get capital in the hands of organizations that want to put it to its highest and best use? So with you there, Chives.
Boy, that's fascinating, John. So of course, you know, don't need to name any names or kiss and tell, but you're indicating that you had communicated with a company in the past which had used these depository shares, but their underwriter did that without their knowledge. I'm trying to understand. I wouldn't have thought that would happen. Maybe that's naive of me.
Yeah, so let me give you an example. So I'm talking specifically about ADRs here, where it's a depository that gets normally brought into the States. So, you know, they're sponsored and unsponsored, right?
Yeah. An ADR is going to involve CD & Co., of course, and be a bit more complicated than, I suppose a lot more common and maybe less complicated than what I was imagining here. But okay, yeah, I mean, it's still either way, they should really know that's happening.
I mean, there's different perspectives on it. Like, I remember when I was a kid, Razer, the gaming company, they intentionally started up this program, got everything registered with a bank, put, you know, millions and millions of shares in a holding company in a bank in America, and used that to sell to U.S. investors. And there are, like, precedents and regulatory schemes to go through. So, like, with GameStop, it was an S3. With other guys, it might be an F1. It might be different systems that they use for filing it. But then once it's here, you know, everyone can trade it, everyone can hold it. There's that approach where the company endorses it and they're working directly with the bank. And then there, as we said, there's this other approach. It's not too complicated. All it is the bank that acting independently, and they see that some company is doing really well. They buy 50 million shares of the stock. They put it all in an account and then issue that receipt on through CD onto Wall Street. And it's permissionless in the sense that they can just buy up the shares in mass in the expectation that they'll be able to sell it to investors at a profit, and they just do it on their own. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty incredible, but yeah, it does make sense. And, you know, in the context of, just as you had mentioned, right, they're looking for equity, and at the end of the day, you know, you can look before you leap, but This is complicated stuff, and they will need the money in their pocket for, be it debt paying off, be it expansions, be it, you know, what do you call it? Research and development, could be anything, right? And they want that stuff today. They don't want it 3 weeks from now or more after they've had the time to become, you know, a FINRA arbiter or whatever they needed to do. Yeah, that, I appreciate that additional information there, John. And I want to welcome 6 Days. I saw you hopped on as well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I got interested in what John was talking about. And so I had a couple quick questions, and then also just some experience from DRSing ADRs. I guess the way that I'm understanding it is that a sponsored ADR would be where someone like BNY Mellon would work with a foreign company to buy some of their shares, and then they would sell those shares in the U.S. And then an unsponsored ADR would be where someone just goes out and does that without working with the foreign issuer. Is that correct?
Yeah, 6 Days. So really what's happening here and what's at stake here is a company outside of the States trying to join our most advanced, developed, and liquid capital market and be part of it. There's different levels for the sponsored ADR when the company actively pursues it. At the highest tier of involvement, they might actually be raising capital, and they might be going to the bank to sell new shares, and those shares will sit here in the States. And unfortunately, because of the way the systems are set up, right, they don't really interoperate between the different countries' trading and settlement systems. So there's always sort of this arbitrage between the ADR shares. Said you DRS ADR shares, so you probably know this firsthand. There's an arbitrage between the actual stock in the home country versus that ADR side. But so on the lower end, maybe it's just that the company just wants it in the States so they could maybe build up some investor interest, or so they could have some people buying at the shares and people try to arbitrage it. The demand goes up because there's more people in the market. And so that you could do that in a sponsored way where you wouldn't raise any capital. You just have it in the U.S. And then it's just a question of sort of how, quote unquote, big you want to go with it, if you want it on OTC or if you want it on like the NASDAQ. Ultimately, this gets into something that we kind of talked about last week with the idea of different trading venues. And just to recap, so we all remember here that the reason there are these different trading venues originally was because of Wall Street trying to undercut Wall Street. It was just them trying to charge less than the other person and make some business for themselves. And that has always been true. That's why ATSs and dark pools exist. At the start of the day, it was always about undercutting on fees. And we can kind of dive more into this because I know we want to get back to the ADR side. The unsponsored ADRs, it really is just, yeah, them buying it and then putting them. Usually it's on an OTC market. Like that's what Razor was. And it's interesting. You get the fees every year from the bank. You get the dividends from the bank. And Razor actually got, well, they went private, so we got that payment from the bank as well. So now you're actually completely just custodied off from the actual issuer. And I don't think that's an effective way to do it. You look at some of the solutions we talked about last week for actually managing equity, doing it right through the TA. And, you know, I've had major banks that, you know, some of them are NDA, and you might know the names if I spoil them. But, I mean, they come to me and they're trying to build up this share management system. And they try to build it on these systems, like some of the chains that some of the entities mentioned last week use. And the fundamental challenge with them is that this trading part is so important. It is so crucial to effective markets. And it is the reason why something like these depository receipts exist. It's the reason that RSUs exist normally on the smaller scale, especially in private companies where those markets don't exist. And they have to approximate the value of the stock using an accountant's best guess. They call it an independent accounting record. It's a 409. It's a specific thing where you have someone come in and guess the price of your stock. And the only reason that happens is because there aren't efficient markets for buying and selling shares. And that caused price discovery, right? Where you have actual public information that you can judge the value off of. And we can talk more about that, but I just wanted to say that one thing. And I'm working on formalizing this into more depth, and just a lot going on, but I'm, you know, working all my butt off trying to get all this documented and also put it all open source so you can follow along. But it's this idea that competition is fragmentation, if you ask me, in capital markets. When you split up the volume, or when you charge any fees for trading on the exchange, it by its nature creates fragmentation, where there's competition between different trading venues trying to attract volume, make profits, grow business. And that is innately inefficient. It's why in Web3 today, you see these dozens of routing protocols that scan all these exchanges, just like the traditional Wall Street model, where there are all these different exchanges and the broker has to scan all of them. And it's so complicated that most of them outsource that to someone like an Apex. And then they're scanned. That's not efficient. It's not efficient to have 50 different places to send the order. So all these different order books, and then you can cheat the system by having these microsecond delays in one versus another. That's not efficient. We just need, in my view, a single solution that works for everyone that has, by design, a protocol interface without charges that just lets the price discovery happen, lets capitalism formulate it by its own, on its own, and ultimately transact without the burden of thinking, oh, I'm making a trade here, but I could be getting a better price somewhere else. Because that's not efficient. It's just, in my view, and challenge, I mean, let me know what you think, but most efficient if we all just have our volume in one place, so all liquidity is there for everybody, and there's no preferential access, because you can pay $40,000 a month for a specific trading route.
I mean, I think you're hitting philosophically just the absolute nail on the head here, John, because right at the end of the day, or maybe at the middle of the day where we are, so many of these legacy exchanges, what they're doing is viewing the service that they're providing, you know, the order book that they're providing. That's the service that they are visualizing and with a profit motive. And it's not, you know, you talk about efficiency in, you know, as you just laid out. And yeah, I mean, if we're thinking about in terms of informational efficiency, in terms of investor access and an equitable understanding of what's happening in our capital markets, it's not efficient. But if you're these big players and you're thinking about, you know, dollars to donuts and profit at the end of the day and payment for order flow and preferential relationships with other large players, you know, then their current model is what's efficient, right? And it's about a different view and understanding of that efficiency and what our actual goals are when it comes to providing a trading playground for, you know, all of the many, many individuals, be they professional or retail investors. You know, I am of the same mind as you that something more focused on providing this framework and not allowing the motivation of, you know, capitalization and competition to, you know, permutate that into something that's, well, less efficient in this term of efficiency. So yeah, I mean, I really appreciate all of that. And boy, it's only more clear to me than ever each day that the power players that are already established in that space just simply have a very different definition of efficiency.
I did have one more question real quick about ADR, sponsored and unsponsored. I guess it would be particularly an unsponsored ADR. If you DRS that, you know, what do you actually own if, you know, in this case that you're talking about, they don't even know that, you know, an American company is offering their shares. So, you know, do you have any input on that?
Six days. I'm just curious. First, do you have personally any DRS shares of companies that are using unsponsored ADRs?
You know what? I'll have to check that. I believe that I do. I know I've got. I believe sponsored level 1, 2, and 3. I'll have to double check and make sure that I do have an unsponsored. I'm not at home right now, and I can't check that, but. I don't know if you want to answer the hypothetical situation or not, but even if it is a sponsored ADR, you know, what do you really own? You know, is your relationship with the company, you know, or is it with the sponsor?
Well, maybe John can speak to it better. I guess my off the cuff thinking would be, I'm not sure that unsponsored ADRs can be DRS, but it may be that they can. And if they are, then I'm not sure who you know, how that relationship would break down. For the ones which are sponsored, the company is involved in the process. 'Cause my thinking would be that they, you know, in seeking, you know, asylum for some of them shares in the US markets, they will have also needed to, orchestrate a client relationship with a registered transfer agent.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess what I can do is I can look and see if I have any unsponsored ADRs. And then if I do, we could do, you know, a 5 or 10 minute follow up on, you know, next week's space.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. John, do you have any further info on that at the moment?
Well, firstly, love that you're really diving into it. You have all three tiers of sponsored ADRs, DRS, and maybe some unsponsored ones too, 6 days. That is stellar. I mean, really incredible work doing that, because no one does that. I mean, that's really awesome.
Thank you. As you know, a lot of it was just by accident. You know, you start to DRS enough stocks and you look at the back end and you go, what the heck is this? And you start to ask questions, and you know, here I am, question I've never really thought about, which is, you know, what do you actually own if, in theory, you can DRS unsponsored ADR? But really, you know, a lot of what I'm doing is just testing, because a lot of things you can just hypothesize about, you know, what should happen, what we think would happen, what I'm reading about would happen. And then, you know, I think what I like to do is just go ahead and do it and see what the heck happens and then talk about that.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. That's a tremendous approach to it. And it sounds like you're really approaching it with a hands-on, focused, diligent, and comprehensive look into the market from a real-world perspective. So tremendous. That's really incredible, 6 days. So great work there. Deserve a clap on that. What I think about, you know, ultimately, it sounds like the question here comes down to where is the ownership recorded? This is one of the reasons that I open sourced Tab3, because you're dealing with a lot of different jurisdictions when you start to talk about these ADRs, these foreign issuers, and the transfer agent rules in the states are, you know, there's the 17 rules on the AD series, the rest apply to clearing agencies. And that's, I mean, those are old rules. I think the, you know, the newest one that you could decipherably call new is preparing for Y2K. And I mean, these, they're very limited, because every single time they try to do anything new with it, there's this huge pushback, because there's these incumbent transfer agents that offer extremely limited services. We talked yesterday about the lack of service from transfer agents in terms of actually, you know, doing anything. You know, we talked about how you couldn't even transact with one of them that is a major top three contender, and it doesn't even load in the price feed from any kind of data source. And it's silly. But these are for-profit companies, right? And how do they make money? They can either charge issuers more, which they try to do as much as they can with consulting, or they lower the services that they offer to the end users or the investors like us, right? And it's really unfortunate, but it's just the case. And so if you think about this outside of the U.S., it's really just that problem scaled up, because these markets evolved. They sort of, you know, in Africa, for instance, they have cellular towers, but they don't have landlines, because they didn't have to build the landlines before the cell towers. They just didn't ever build landlines. And then someone came in and built the cell towers, right? So they just sort of skipped a generation, so to speak. And it seems like that's the approach that's been taken in a lot of other countries, based off my diligence into the transfer agent practices abroad, is that the rules are not very well defined in a lot of countries. And so the question is, for these ADRs, if you want to get that certificate, firstly, can you even withdraw the shares from that American bank custodian and bring it back to the home country? Because normally when it's at the home country, especially if it's an ADR, you're just talking about the shares on the stock exchange. So that's still through a broker. That's not even with the actual company. And that's the approach that I see most of the time, because it's extremely hard. If you look at when you buy an ADR, it's like a huge contract, right? And you look through all that and you read the micro prints, and really it's creation and redemption isn't like the same as with an ETF, where a normal person can just do sort of the blocks, right? And instead, it's really just that promise for this one depository share, unless the bank itself wants to go in and make the transfer. So for the unsponsored ones, to think that they would actually move you from having a share position in the U.S. because of all these artificial walls that are created around the electronic systems for the record keeping, to think that they would try to take you out of that system, put you in a foreign system, and then put it in your name at a transfer agent in another country. It's unfortunately, from my perspective, it's unprecedented in that no one is really taking a comprehensive global approach to the securities compliance and regulations, so that you could actually trade with someone across the borders instead of just holding it in your own name and not being able to really do anything with it, which is what unfortunately some of the systems are like. Unless you introduce a broker or an ATS or some other kind of middleman on top of it, which I don't think is the right approach. It really should all be facilitated with your own custody. And I've never tried a DRS, a sponsored ADR. It's really interesting approach. And a lot of times, you know, we talk about how difficult it is to find transfer agents for American companies just to figure out who they are. And I picture, and I've seen a lot of cases, that there isn't really as much transfer agent interest outside the states. because it's not as ingrained into the regulatory framework. They just think stock, you know, just like most of most investors, right? They just think stock exchanges and brokers. And in countries outside of the U.S., a lot of the times that financial knowledge isn't there, and they just rely on the investment banker to give them the info, and they funnel them into the brokers and onto the private stock exchanges. Canada is a really interesting example because the stock exchange there is also sort of a one of the main operatives of the transfer agent systems in place there. And so the infrastructure is almost intertwined between the private equity stock exchange and the traditional stock exchange in Toronto. And because of that, it's actually like governmentally challenging to compete on the transfer agent side because of the way that the regulations are set up. And it's, I mean, I could talk more like all day on this because it just gets deep into politics. Basically, what I found out after a couple of years of working on this, I realized, wow, you know, a lot of this is really just politicking, because what we're dealing with is no small feat. We are talking about the allocation of capital across societies. And that is really something that I think we have the potential to, you know, there's certainly the perspective that we're going to force Wall Street to innovate. And, you know, if we can build a functional DRS, it can incent them to do better and to do more. But I really, from my seeing it all firsthand, watching brokers take, you know, 60%+ or, you know, a third of my trade and just profit it, I really do not think that they have the answer. I think that what we can do is really put that replacement system in effect, bring it to the regulators, the companies, and the investors, and through that process, create a functional equivalent that supersedes and becomes a new standard that everyone can build on. Because ultimately, I'll shoot it back to you 6 days, because I think I've gone quite away from the ADRs, because it really pains me just to even think of how many intermediaries are involved. From the, you know, there's everyone on the foreign stock exchange intermediary, then coming down to just introducing 3 to 4 new intermediaries. Once you get it into CD, it's just, it's ridiculous that these systems are so convoluted. And really, we just need something in place so that, you know, you or team or anyone that wants to, you can come and work on it. Talked to a group recently, and their entire startup was just building a new feature into the Farcaster and the Warpcaster platform to improve their social media dynamics and experience. And they can do that because it's open, it's available to anyone, and it's a system where you can put in the effort, improve the network, and have that understandably, certainly, and longstandingly stay as a foundational piece of infrastructure for anyone to use. And I think that's what we have the potential to do here. Does that cover the main items for your 6 days? It's definitely a complex chain of custody. So I'm glad that we have someone like you tackling it head on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. You know, usually when you're talking, everybody just kind of sits back and probably feels smarter just listening to you. So I appreciate it. And we like you going into the depth of the conversations that that you go into. So I appreciate it. It sounds like I need to just, you know, I need to log into my account and see if I do have this mythical unsponsored DRS ADR, and that'll bring up a whole slew of conversations if I do have one. So I'm looking forward to that. And thank you again for, you know, for answering my question.
Yeah, of course, 6 days. It's weird. A lot of times it's a negotiation between the broker. I think I remember a while back you saw this where they charged you like an overdraft account fee at CS. But then they didn't charge you like the fund reversal fee or something, or there was some purchase price where they never actually fully charged you. And I've definitely had the same thing happen. I've like heckled my broker to give me back the ADR fees. It's weird. Like the control that they have, the power they have to click a button and add hundreds of dollars to your account. It's a power that doesn't seem quite efficiently regulated, overseen, or
yeah, and maybe just, you know, give some insight into how much power and potentially money they're making, you know, doing this. That you know, if you go into a bank and try to get $35 for a you know, an overdraft fee, it could be difficult. I mean, it's difficult to get money back from anybody that's overcharged you, but that's interesting if they're just, oh yeah, you know, we'll just credit it a couple $100 and just go on their way. So yeah, I think that some of these fees, I think that the transfer agent industry in general has been described to me a little bit like the Wild West, where you know, it's not well regulated in that, you know, that anybody can start a transfer agency. You know, you just have to go get the clients and maybe kind of know what you're doing. But that's how it had been kind of described to me. And just seeing, you know, some of the way that the fees and the minimums and, you know, even just, you know, I kind of piggybacking off your conversation where you had said that someone had an ADR that the foreign issuer wasn't aware of. You know, I've talked to American issuers where they weren't aware that you could buy stock directly through ComputerShare. You know, that was just, they were like, wait, what? You know, and they didn't care. You know, they're like, oh, that's news to me. I didn't know that. And so, you know, I think the way that we look at things as investors and just logging into our account and the things that we're seeing, the people that we're questioning, you know, issuers, investor relations departments and things like that, they're just, you know, a lot of them, they probably think we're wasting their time, but we really have a different perspective and we're seeing things that I don't think that they would be aware of if we weren't bringing it to their attention.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing to highlight in 6 days as well. You know, that I've heard from you and seen some for myself that issuers maybe are not all that familiar with some of the different, let's say, you know, I guess plan options, you know, bells and whistles, things included with their transfer agent package, and stuff like direct stock is a great example. You know, we're talking about sponsored versus unsponsored ADRs, and direct stock is a unsponsored example of a investment plan where the issuing company is not administering, is not sponsoring the plan in any way. It's just sort of an add-on that is available to them through their transfer agent. And so it makes some sense that they might not be directly aware when, you know, it's happening outside of their jurisdiction. They're not overseeing in any direct way these at the market purchases through the plan. So it's a great, I think, adjacent thing to be discussing in terms of company oversight. I think we may be getting away from speaking about dilution when talking about plans. But one thing that I've, you know, that I hadn't thought about until now that does kind of tie back in, and maybe you know, John. So is it when a foreign company is seeking to introduce ADR shares, you know, in my mind with a sponsored ADR, is it typical for them to issue new shares to do that? Because that would be another sort of dilutive event if they did.
Yeah, I definitely say that's the most common reason for bringing shares into the U.S., just because there's that ongoing reporting requirement, depending on exactly which offering they go through. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, what we're dealing with here are companies that want to grow, expand, and profit their investors. And if they need to fundraise to do that, to build up a capital base, if they're starting off with not too much cash, but great grand visions, just like, you know, Ryan, then that's the exact situation where we have the privilege of being the home of our most advanced, developed, and liquid capital market that makes it easier than any other country to raise those funds. Once you just do those regulatory requirements and do the reporting, give the investors the information to accurately value your company. Reg S is sort of the most common one, I'd say, on that front. And this just dives into sort of the different offering types. But that's exactly right, where they just want to come in, be part of the system. And we have the fortune of having the de facto standard system for any company that is building something of size. And to keep that in place, to stay dominant, to maintain that position of power, the source of capital for these innovators, it's going to, in my view, require outpacing the, you know, foreign competition to create a competing standard, which will use blockchain. It's just a question of whether we want to be the leaders, create a gold standard, and really take the 100 years of experience we have dealing with securities fraud and put it into practice on a global scale, or whether we want to let limited case laws in other jurisdictions try to piecemeal together what the SEC has been able to do. Does that make sense, Chives?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And hey, look, innovation is going to be key if, you know, in any kind of market space for any kind of market leader, if they want to, you know, perpetrate that market leadership over a long term. And, you know, it's a great point that you're making, that it is an incredible, you know, beacon of fortune that the, you know, for all their shortcomings, that the U.S. markets are what so many other foreign companies, be they established or new, look towards when they are thinking about trying to engage with a wider investor base and seeking to raise that capital, you know. But in the same sense of, you know, what you were just saying in terms of how our markets need to innovate in order to maintain that reality, you know, one of the key things that I'd love to see innovated is, and this, you know, speaks to what we've discussed plenty of times as well, you know, when that new capital comes in, of course it can be good for the company abroad, provided it's a sponsored ADR, you know, that they are enjoying the fruits of all of that. But who else benefits? It ends up being these legacy and incumbent leadership, you know, with lopsided power and access here in the domestic American markets, as opposed to investors like Six Days, who might want to, you know, invest in such and such a company and hold it directly and become involved. There is just very little ability and transparency in order to do that. And so much of the value add from a American perspective, it's so lopsided towards the top end, the brokers that are ensuring that these relationships are liquid and the exchanges that are benefiting off of the arbitrage that you mentioned between these two different trading jurisdictions. And these are other areas in which, you know, innovation would really be helpful. And the trouble that we will consistently encounter, I think, is that the innovation that we're discussing, you know, flies in the face of techniques which have been profitable for a long time.
Yeah,
I guess is maybe the simplest way to say it, right?
Yeah, this just ties, in my view, right back to what was being talked about in the Discord, in the sandbox discussion. You know, ICE made, you know, like almost, you know, over $3 billion a year, roughly, right? Operating the world stock exchanges. And what we were looking at in that conversation was basically saying, well, what if all those exchanges were just, you know, an open source blockchain that is operated on not-for-profit basis? And then the brokers were just, you know, protocols, layers on top of that blockchain, and enabling the shares to just be the tokens on the chain, right? And, you know, it sounds so simple. All it requires is that you bankrupt, I don't know, $15 billion of annual profits in these Wall Street guys every single year to the benefit and to the pockets and to the retirement portfolios of the investors themselves.
Oh, is that all? Yeah, it sounds so simple. there's some famous quote. I can't remember the guy, but, you know, I'm sure everyone knows it, where, you know, it's hard to teach someone, or get someone to understand something if their livelihood depends on them not understanding it.
I mean, that's exactly what it is. You look at these what's the number one source of income for brokers besides securities lending? Okay, what? It's the money management, right? If people just knew how to invest and could, like, read a book on how to buy index funds, they'd be better than their portfolio guy 9 out of 10 times, and maybe some tax rotating stuff. you know, the wash sales. And I mean, it's like, it's trivial. The level of what the service they provide in exchange for a compounding take of your retirement is ridiculous. I mean, you look at the plan admin fees on 401k just to buy like 7 index funds, and it's 50 basis points annually to the company. That's coming out of your paycheck. It's just unbelievable to think that it's just such a, we talked last week about a fireman's union taught, you know, not understanding the investment options because you outsource it to somebody else. But man, if you could just feel the $50,000 coming out of your wallet in cold hard cash every single year that you have that investment professional dealing with your portfolio, I mean, I think you'd have it. I think I would have a different perspective on hiring some Wall Street guy who has a background in financial accounting to try to manage an investment portfolio at a rate better than the top hedge funds on the world.
Right, especially in the market environment, you know, on average over the last few decades. I mean, with some outlier years, of course, but generally stocks go up if you're choosing to invest broadly, which is, of course, what all these guys do. They're trained to avoid volatility. And so, I mean, if that's all you were going to do anyway, it is fascinating how pervasive these kinds of investment theses are, where you need to have some suit and tie fella. You know, and sure, maybe in years past you did, because there was not as much consumer access to, you know, freely choosing. But nowadays, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry down the road can buy an ETF if they want to, or get into a mutual fund if they want to. It's not as though there's gatekeeping there. But there is when it comes to the information, not just the education, but the information in the first place. So you have to pay for it to get it, or you have to search it out. But realistically, you're never going to get the same information that the big guys have. And then even then, you've got to, you know, devote hours and hours of your time people don't have, to being able to parse that information and turn it into something that could be valuable for yourself.
The way I see it, for a lot of people, the, you know, having had markets basically take over my life firsthand, I agree with this perspective. You can either be, you know, really good at your main job and put all your time and effort into that, or you can be like pretty good at your main job and then also spend your time, you know, learning to invest and finding all the right things to do and trading and such, and then you can actually be wealthy that way. And unfortunately, it's a trade-off perpetuated by how difficult it is to access quality, independent money managers that have a proven track record. Because how do you prove a track record based off of brokerage PDFs and word of mouth? It's very difficult. It's something only about 1% of people can do. And that's why about 1% of people manage all the money. And if we could just sort of democratize the process of, you know, easily and passively allocating funds to the best investment strategies, which can only happen, in my view, if you have the actual trading data on a public chain where you can analyze it against existing open risk metrics, that's when you can really start to have some social change and some wealth transfer from the elusive clubs available to a select few, and instead put it in the hands. I mean, why is it that nobody could copy the trades that DFV made if they had his blockchain wallet and saw him make them and believed in what he was doing in the early days or even later on? There's no reason in that. It's just that public information, he puts it on Twitter or on, you know, whatever, puts it on a thread on a sub. It's the exact same thing. It's just automated and it's all done transparently. So you can't cheat, can't manipulate screenshots, can't lie. It's all right there on chain. And yeah, I could talk all day on the long-term implications there, because you're democratizing access to money management. You're democratizing access to capital allocation. You're democratizing access to the root function of value itself when it comes to innovators, investors, and ultimately regulators who approve and oversee and form all disclosures around the management aspect.
Yeah, and it's not just retail trading either. I mean, to wrap this back to the dilution trading discussion, right? If we could have this hypothetical environment where public on-chain tracking is you know, something which is possible for not just for trades themselves, but for new issuances and the manner and smart contracts by which they are defined, then there would not be this need for such broad and vague language in the in the filings outlining them necessarily. I suppose there still would be, but point being, as soon as action was taken, it'd be quite clear to investors what form that action took. You would not need to wait in the same way for follow-up filings to define if it was simply more common shares that were issued, or if all of a sudden there are a assortment of warrants and stock options or units which have been distributed amongst X or Y or Z investor base or private equity firm or whatever it might have been. There's definitely conversation there. Is that good? Is that bad? Who's to say? But what would be nice, I think, is more transparency for investors. That's something that I will always, I think, want to be seeking leveling up with, because there is just too much ambiguity and asynchronicity when it comes to these different things in the markets. Every person should have the same access and is deserving of the same access. These are a collective, the markets are a collective creation. It's everyone's interests together. And that's only becoming more and more true as the years go by, the amount of money wrapped up in the markets, which is, considered to be allocated to retail in some way, like through pension funds, only seems to go up year after year.
That's right. That's right. Gosh, I got to run, Ties. I'm completely with you. And it's about giving the money back to the companies too, so that they can, sell their shares right to investors transparently and not pay, with this GME example, $32.5 million in fees.
1.5%.
That's not efficient. I don't care how you put it. To think that you can't just put a limit sell order in an order book based off the shelf offering, because you have to go through these custodies, these intermediaries. We're not just diluting the investors when we have these offerings in the traditional system, but we're diluting the company itself by forking over that income right to Wall Street.
Great point, John. Yeah, absolutely. That's, $32 million there is not nothing. And that's happening all the time. Every time a company is needing to go through these sorts of measures to raise capital, well, they would have had to dilute less if they could have more efficiently raised that capital. I really appreciate your stopping by, John. I know you mentioned you had to get going.
Yeah, of course. Is there anything else for Music Days?
Guess not.
Well, a great discussion and a really important topic in either case, and definitely diving into the offering types and how companies raise money. And at least for me, that was the foray into realizing that what's at stake here is more than trading. It really is how society distributes and allocates and employs.
Hey, I'm sorry. My phone was a little bit away from me. I got home and I had logged on to my account, and it does all the ADRs I have DRS'd are all sponsored. They're either sponsored level 1, 2, or 3. So that clears that up, at least for what I've got. That might make me, try to find a sponsored ADR and try to DRS it. Project. Yeah. So I did want to kind of follow up with that. And, now we don't have to wait a week for that. So thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks, 6 days. Yeah, maybe we can find and test out. I'm wondering if I'm right. My surmission is that I don't imagine that we'd be able to have you DRS a non-sponsor, but we gonna have to find out. Yeah, let's see what the brokers say. Stick feet to fire on that one.
Yeah, maybe what we could do is just try to find some popular companies that are on unsponsored ADRs and then just start there.
Yep.
And you have them as actual certificates, 6 days? Are they from the company or the custodian?
I have, well, these are just, it's both. So I have, you know, DRS shares, and then once they're DRS'd, you can request a certificate, a paper certificate. And, I do have paper certificates for ADRs, also. So a lot of people don't know this. I would say at least on ComputerShare, over half of issuers still offer paper certificates. And, what I find interesting is that the banks, seem to be who's pushing for everyone else to take, their, stocks out of paper form. Yet, I believe it's 10 out of the top 12 biggest banks still offer paper certificates. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, do as I say and not what I do is the way that I'm seeing it. But, you know, ComputerShare does have a, I don't believe any other transfer agent has this. I really would, if anyone knows differently, I would love to hear about it. But ComputerShare has a print on demand paper certificate program. And so, you know, the old way would be like GameStop would order 1,000 pieces of paper with serial numbers already on there. Then they have to pay the transfer agent to hold these 1,000 pieces of paper. Then they have to audit these 1,000 pieces of paper every year. And there's all these fees that are involved. And so what most issuers that I've found, you know, whether it's Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan or Tesla or Walmart, is that they ditch the old, what I call good looking certificates. And they just use these, you know, print on demand certificates. I've seen four different colors that ComputerShare offers. They've got blue, green, and orange. And depending on, you know, if you're a bank, they're probably using blue. If it's maybe a cannabis company or whatever, they're using green. And then a lot of the ADRs, at least the BNY Mellon, are they're kind of purplish. These certificates, if you want them as a investor, you can get them. They're $25. And usually right after you request one, you'll have it within about 5 days. And there are some benefits to paper certificates that I'm crazy about that I haven't really found a lot of other people that care about. But I do believe if more issuers knew that when their certificates ran out, that they could replace them with this print on demand paper certificate program, I believe that more issuers would be interested in at least offering the paper for people that want it. And so I've been trying to kind of spread the word. Like GameStop, they used to have, you know, old certificates that were unique to them. And then when they ran out, they just didn't do anymore. And I think it would be great if they, you know, shifted to this print on demand. So it's really, if anybody wants them, it costs you money. And so it's not, you know, people aren't just going to order a bunch just to do it. You know, they're, every time you get one, it's $25. If it has one share on it, it's $25. If it has 1,000 of your shares, you know, it's $25. So anyways, to answer your question, there are ADRs that have certificates, and I have a bunch of them.
Wow. That's incredible, 6 days. Let's definitely dive more into that. I got to run, but just some counter perspective for you there. There are actual, like, SEC, and I love that you're doing it because it's so important, and investing your own funds and time and really diving deep to do all that technically is just a tremendous effort. So love that, 6 days. Really incredible. It's interesting to note, you know, just like when we first joined the Medallion Signature Guarantee Program, there's a big list of all the lost stamps, and you have to check against those. It's the same for certificates. So there's actually an SEC-identified corporation that runs a program that all the transfer agents that offer certificates have to pay dues to, and their forms, they're digital now. They used to be Form X17 F1A, where the transfer agents report the certificate numbers if they do get lost, and then it'll actually dive into all the deep and ongoing insurance costs around dealing with certificates. And it does get very expensive, as you suggested, especially when they get lost. It's a real headache. If you do offer, I mean, that's one of the reasons we don't have certificates. And so, you know, definitely a whole rabbit hole to dive into there in terms of the hidden costs, and that we should really just be able to rectify it by keeping it all digital. So tons more. Love to dive there on the chat. Have a great night, guys. Tremendous conversation. Great job, Chives, in 6 days.
Yeah, have a good night, John.
Hey, Chives, I actually got kicked off right when he was trying to tell me about what he had just said. I'm guessing it has to do with so I didn't hear what he said the last, like, 3 minutes. Could you maybe kind of summarize it real quick?
I can try. He was indicating that there is a SEC branch or subdivision, I guess, where there is a, like, a certificate information resource which tracks the serial numbers and so on. And so transfer agents need to actually participate kind of in this program, which involves other fees. So when they, you know, if certs are lost or if new ones are issued, there's additional communications that have to happen between the transfer agent and the SEC, I suppose, to flag duplicates, things like this. And I think John's point was that this is another area where potential costs can come in, and why, you know, maybe some companies might be moving away from certs, or why the print on demand, which is purely electronic at first, you know, until they're actually printed, why those might be more advantageous. But he kind of summarized by saying that overall, a transition to a wholly electronic and book entry method would be even more advantageous. And yeah, I know that's something that you and him will have to dive into more deeply probably another time, because I know that you have a lot of latent interest in certificates in a more broad sense, than, and think they have you know, their own benefits beyond what can be offered by custodial book entry securities.
Thank you. Yeah, I know it's kind of a you know, something that interests me that doesn't interest, you know, most people, but the more, you know, I thought it was you know, I didn't appreciate certificates until I got the first one. And then I started to see on the back end, you know, what it did to my account is what I would say. And so, you know, one of the things, benefits that I see is, you know, that certificates show is not available, you know, which really means, you know, they can't be moved around without surrendering the certificate, or, you know, saying that it's lost. And so, you know, when I know when people talk about, well, if someone un-DRSs my shares or moves my shares or does whatever, I call it an extra layer of security. Some people call it less secure because you could lose your certificate. But anyways, we could probably dive into that with a whole space. So I know it's something that interests me that, you know, it doesn't interest as many people. So I'll dive into that with John some other time.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. It's a broad subject which absolutely needs its own spotlight. And I don't know if it's people aren't interested. I wouldn't say that. I think it's just people aren't thinking about it as often. Probably hasn't really crossed their mind the history of dematerialization and this slow trend towards you know, electronic, and what sort of implications that has and how things are tracked. And I'm interested in speaking about it, but we've been going a while, I suppose. Maybe it'll be better for next week or another week. I'm definitely excited to, you know, we'll check your schedule and we'll find when it could be a good time. Okay.
Awesome. Sounds great.
What I'd love to do is, you know, just to wrap up the umbrella conversation regarding dilution, I wanted just to touch on, and this is brief, but, the ways in which dilution directly affects bottom line investors, because you know, and I think this is pretty straightforward, but worth mentioning as we were you know, kind of following up from our broader and initial discussions on the topic. Essentially, the main two things I wanted to mention. The first is that, you know, investors upon dilution events, they have their ownership percentage in the company reduced. And in my view, most crucially, that corresponds to a decrease in the voting power of incumbent investors. You know, and that is just something I think is so important to keep in mind, that, you know, the legacy group of investors, you know, be they retail or institutional or insider, whichever, you know, once there is a dilution event stock is sold in the market, or other more complicated types of vehicles are used, either way, the incumbent group of investors, you know, they have their voting power reduced by that much, you know. So if a stock dilutes by 20%, then, you know, all of the investors that, you know, were eligible to vote and impact company policy in the previous year are now only 80% as able to impact. Again, I think that, you know, while that's obvious, I think it's such an important thing to think about and for companies to remember, especially in the context that we'd like to see, you know, of expanding direct registered holding, you know, representation by investors. Because, you know, we've done plenty of episodes on voting, on how important DRS is in ensuring not just that your vote gets cast, but that it is counted. And in that context, you know, if you're someone who wants to impact your company most directly as possible and ensure that you have that line of communication, then dilution events are unfortunate because they're limiting your ability to you know, express that voice. That's the biggest negative in my view. Now, as far as positives go, often investors will see an adjustment simply enough in their the actual effective value of their investment. You know, we had discussed this a bit earlier, but long story short, you know, perhaps during a dilutive event, the value can go down. But what I mean by effective value is, like, if you you're as a stockholder, you have probably unrealized gains, you know, if stock prices are going up. So even if your voting power, your ownership percentage, that may have gone down, but in terms of the dollar value of what you hold, that can often go up in many cases. And that maybe may seem strange at first because the company is, you know, selling shares into the market. And while that, you know, does dilute the individual value of shares at first, it creates a lot of equity for the company and it opens up a lot of doors, whether or not that's paying off debt or seeking new ventures, as I'd covered earlier. And so a lot of the time, what you end up finding is in the period following the completion of these different shelf offerings, a lot of the time the actual market capitalization of companies goes up. And so, you know, that's certainly medium term. What happens longer term? I mean, that there's always variance there. Sometimes companies make a big announcement, whether or not they've paid off debt or sought an acquisition. Other times they're seeking a more conservative investment strategy and do not, make any kind of larger announcement. And maybe that can affect investor sentiment. But generally speaking, historically, from what I was able to find, it does seem like there is a you know, medium-term improvement in, you know, unrealized value. And so that's, I suppose, important just to realize as well. But boy, I do think that the ownership percentage impact, on the, you know, what I'd consider, probably the most loyal investors, the ones that are, you know, were holding already, right? Then those are the ones that, you know, that is an unfortunate consequence. But I suppose it's always, you know, planting seeds, hoping for something better. Companies are typically doing these things because they feel they need that equity for some reason. Debt can be harmful. Growth can be wonderful. And so it's with investors in mind. Boards do have fiduciary duty to try to do the best in terms of, you know, end of the day, making shareholders as whole as possible. So just wanted to kind of frame these couple of pros and cons with that in mind, to kind of to cap things off. What do you think, 6 days? Any thoughts on that?
Sorry, I've got my phone down, and whenever you call me up, I've got to unlock my phone and get back in. So, no, I think that you covered it great. I think, you know, we obviously had a big dilution with GameStop, and, you know, a lot of people are, you know, just wondering what's going on. And, you know, I do know before the dilution, I think that we had, actually there were two dilutions. So I think that we had maybe $3 or $4 a share before the dilutions. And now I guess we've got $10 a share. So, you know, I've been really trying to figure out, you know, compared to other dilutions. We had talked about it a little bit today and I didn't get my spreadsheet ready, but really I know Larry Chang has talked a little bit about how some dilutions are good and some are bad. And of course, you know, because he is on GameStop's board, that, you know, a lot of people think he wouldn't be bringing that up unless he believed GameStop's was good. And so, you know, I'm in that belief as well. Of course, you know, losing our ownership percentage, you know, nobody's crazy about. Everybody loves the cash. Everybody's wondering what we're going to do with the cash. And so I think that, you know, we'll really only be able to understand this in hindsight. And, you know, and it's out of our control. You know, it really is out of our control. So I do know that the company is a heck of a lot healthier with $4 billion than it was when it was $10 with $1 billion cash trading at $10. And we were bullish back then. So it'll be interesting to see how things shake out. I know, you know, I was trying to crunch some numbers comparing AMC's dilution, which I believe they diluted about the same amount of shares. I think this last offering, you know, we did 75 million. They did 72.5 million, you know, so we're talking about 99% the same amount of shares. You know, we raised 2.14 billion and they raised 250 million, you know, so we're looking at, I think we raised, you know, nine times as much money or whatever, not to compare the two, but it's just these dilutions happen so quick and the amount of, I mean, so recent and so close together that it's natural to probably compare the two. And so I do want to kind of crunch some numbers and just really figure out, you know, what the heck Larry Chang is maybe talking about. You know, we have a hunch that the one that GameStop did was good, and we have a hunch, at least I do. I own some AMC shares, so, you know, that I still believe that their dilution was a little bit out of desperation. You know, they're burning through cash. They have $5 billion in debt. You know, we have almost, GameStop has almost no debt and $4 billion in cash. So it really is you know, these are two major differences, but I want to dive into it more and just really, you know, try to crunch the numbers. And honestly, the more GameStop price drops, it almost validates the dilution. You know, people say, well, if they didn't dilute, the price wouldn't be going down. But, you know, we sold shares, I think, at $28 a share, you know, and now if we're trading at $23, was it a good decision, you know, as opposed to, you know, I think AMC diluted at $3 a share and is trading at $5, you know, so I think this is always a moving, you know, when you talk about if things are good or not, it's always a moving target. You know, what is the current market cap? What is the current price? And all these other things. So it's fun to look at, but I really appreciate you going through and just, you know, people don't really know. It's almost like what you're doing is you're teaching. It's almost like you're teaching a class and you have to prepare for this class. And you did that and we all benefit from it. So I appreciate you doing these spaces and doing, you know, the research and bringing this knowledge to us.
Oh, hey, happy to do that. And, you know, it's great to, you know, the best teachers are the ones that are lifelong students. And so I love learning this stuff just as much as I love talking about this stuff. And so it's a great thing to, you know, just be part of a wider community that is also so interested. And you're making some great points there, right? I mean, I would love to speak about this again in a future week with more raw data. Now that we've covered so much of the different forms that the dilution can take and some of the immediate impacts or rationales which undercut these decisions, I'd like to take a much deeper look into the actual data, right? Like I know you just mentioned, so I know GME had a 45 mil and a 75 mil. They had two dilutions, I believe. But what percentage of outstanding does that represent? Same question for AMC, because I would have to imagine it'll probably be a better comparative indicator if we look at the percentage of outstanding following dilution, which is represented by those new shares. You know, because company could have 100 shares outstanding and then issue 75 million new ones, and that'd be very different than if they had a billion outstanding or whatever. So I'm excited to look more into that, and you're doing great work as well with just some of those numbers. The cash value of the shares is always incredible to think about. And that's kind of speaking to what we were just discussing, and you know, the ownership percentage going down versus the bottom line equity for investors going up. You know, we saw in GameStop nearly 25% DRS, and following these dilutive events, that's closer to, off the top of my head, I think closer to 18.5% or so percent. And, but on the other hand, you know, now where they once had, if it was $3, cash represented by any share owned, now that's closer, I think, to a little above $10 owned, just taking the cash on hand and dividing that by the number of shares outstanding. So, you know, kind of like apples and oranges, who's to say what's good or bad about these two things, but it is fascinating to watch these developments. And that's going to be true with any of the companies that we look more into. Definitely going to want to include AMC on that, and plenty of other. Ideally, we can find 6 days between us a variety of dilutive events beyond just issuing common stock into the market, which is what both of these companies did, as I understand. So that'll be great, and look forward to that. Thanks for stopping by 6 days. John, of course, and everyone else that stopped by to listen, all of our future listeners, really appreciate it. 6 days, any final thoughts?
No, not really. I did have maybe one last question that I don't know if it was answered, but when we had talked about units before, you know, the way that I've seen it is just that I haven't ever seen an issuer that sold, let's say, common stock and units, you know, to where you could buy, let's say, common GameStop and units of GameStop. You know, if you're looking at like Icon, you know, sells units. I believe, you know, I talked a little bit about Six Flags and Cedar Fair doing a merger, and I believe that's going to be units. So I, from my understanding, it's, you know, typically either shares, you know, sometimes issuers have like Class A and Class B, but, you know, based on the research that you did, is it, you know, when we talk about units, is it kind of like an either or do you just not know?
Well, based on the research that I'd done, a unit is sort of just like a collective representation of any of the other options for ownership, which were included in the prospectus offering by the company. So a unit could be multiple Class A common shares. It could be a common share and a preferred share. It could be a warrant and a preferred share. It's any combination of non-one integer of these different different vehicles which are available. And that, you know, the language, if you review, for example, the any of GameStop's recent what's the filing number again? It's the 424B5, if you look around Edgar. But really check any company, and they all have this they seem to offer units, and they seem to offer them as this broad, you know, jigsaw assembly of whatever it is that the buyer might have been interested in. So the way I'm choosing to think about it after better understanding that is that if there were some privately interested party that the company was going to be selling to as part of their dilutive offering, then having units available allows them to cobble together whatever seems to fit the buyer's desire, and, you know, assign that whatever price seems fair to both parties. It's essentially a flexibility thing is how I understand it now.
All right. That makes sense. So maybe insiders are buying units, but just regular retail investors can only buy common or something like that.
Yeah. Well, we should see, you know, once the offerings are completed, they need to file with the SEC information about that as well and detail exactly what was sold. So we will be able to find examples of, I did not find any yet, but, I believe that we would be able to find examples of, offerings in which units were sold, who they were sold to, and what they contained, and all that sort of thing. In the case of GameStop, that none were sold and only Class A common shares were sold at the market.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I think what, at least my interpretation of of having all those.
Well, I might have lost you there. You've cut out. Well, we can just give 6 days a moment here, but I think maybe he's cut out just as he was about to share his interpretation, probably of having all of these different vehicles listed.
Sorry, I was actually getting another call, and I think that blocked my space. But no, what I was saying is that having all the different offerings, you know, whether it's preferred shares and all the, you know, warrants and all this other stuff, gives the company a lot of flexibility that they didn't have potentially. And so if they want to, I guess the paperwork's been filed, and then if they want to do something in the future, that's already set up for them. Kind of, you know, we've talked before about, you know, having arsenal in the chamber, you know, to make a move quickly on something that they might want to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. These filings are intentionally made to be broad because circumstances might change, right? I mean, you have a plan in place probably for your dilutive offering when you make that initial filing, but maybe circumstances change, and then you want to have access as a company to some of these other vehicles, and that is why I think it's common for so many of these different things to be described, even in the case where typically just common stock is utilized. It's just for flexibility reasons. There's no reason not to do it. If you didn't do it and then you changed your mind and wanted to, you'd have to do a whole new filing and pay a whole bunch of fees again to your sales agent and the legal practitioner team. What a pain, right? So I think that's probably where that comes from.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they have just really kept all options open, whether it's, selling more shares or now, you know, different types of shares, share buybacks. It seems like they're always a step ahead and really hopefully protecting our, you know, shareholder best interests with, keeping whoever it is that doesn't want GameStop to succeed on their toes.
Well, let's hope so, right? I mean, let's remember that it is the fiduciary responsibility of any board of directors to ensure the best outcomes for their shareholders. But yeah, right there with you. They keep their chips close to the vest, or when they do need to file, they just put a whole bunch of chips on the table they're not going to use.
Yeah, I think it's great, and it's been fun to watch. I think anytime they do something, we always think, well, they're gonna do it, you know. And what we found is that, it's really hopefully a part of a bigger game plan, you know, that that gives them the flexibility to pivot the company in whatever direction they think is best for it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think being able to turn on a dime thanks to flexible filings is worth the admission price. Absolutely. But well, yeah, great stuff. 6 days, great conversation there. And, we'll call it there. Great stuff today. Looking forward to when we'll be able to discuss more in depth about, and boy, lots of future subjects for my notes today. Unsponsored ADRs and a more granular, analytical, approach towards, dilutive impact on other securities. So those will be great things when we get to them, and looking forward to that. Everybody have a really wonderful rest of the day here, and speak to y'all next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.